KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. A scholar who writes about fascism says it isn't just universities that are under attack in America, it's knowledge. And that's why he's leaving Yale for Canada. We'll hear more about his reasons on Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump says tomorrow is Liberation Day when he hikes tariffs on foreign goods. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. So we have a history lesson on how high tariffs for sugar and pickup trucks have played out in America. Also, Israel says it is returning to intense operations in Gaza and more Palestinians need to evacuate, and how to rebuild landmarks destroyed in the LA fires without losing their history. It's Tuesday, April 1st. On this day in 2001, the Netherlands became the first country to legalize same-sex marriage. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Layoffs are underway at the Food and Drug Administration. These come amid an effort to cut the Department of Health and Human Services by 25%. NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports.
Emails went out to FDA staffers early Tuesday morning that they no longer had jobs. The entire team that handles communications for the agency has been cut. According to an HHS fact sheet, 3,500 FDA jobs are being eliminated. It says the drug, device, and food reviewers and inspectors will be spared. Many FDA staffers and their work are funded by user fees paid by the industry. Congress passed the first user fee law in 1992 to fund staffing to speed drug approvals. The fees are paid by drug and device companies as well as the makers of certain tobacco products. Some of the staffers funded by these fees tell NPR they lost their jobs too, but because they weren't paid by taxpayers, those layoffs won't save taxpayer dollars. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
Wisconsin voters are choosing the next justice to sit on the state Supreme Court. The conservative candidate is former Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel. He says Wisconsin's top court should not make decisions for voters.
When judges make decisions about what the law says, they're taking it out of your hands as a voter. Instead of the voters deciding what the law is through their legislative representatives, you got four justices on the Supreme Court that will decide what the law is for you. In the end, that's the death of our republic.
His opponent is Dane County Judge Susan Crawford, a liberal. Tens of millions of dollars have been poured into the race. That includes from liberal George Soros, who donated $2 million to Wisconsin Democrats to support Crawford. Billionaire Elon Musk and his allies gave millions to support the conservative candidate. Musk even gave two $1 million checks to Wisconsin voters. That drew outrage from Wisconsin resident Lynn Olson.
The Elon injection is really destructive. And offering $1 million for a vote has got to be illegal, right? Come on. So I am already voted in favor of Crawford. I'm trying to save democracy.
Elon Musk says he is exercising free speech. Stocks opened lower this morning as NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The S&P 500 index just wrapped up its worst quarter in 3 years, and investors are bracing for more tariffs from the Trump administration, although the White House has offered few details about what's in store. European leaders say they're prepared to fight back against Trump's trade war and have a strong plan to do so. A bankruptcy judge in Texas has rejected Johnson & Johnson's plan to resolve thousands of lawsuits over baby powder by putting a spin-off company into Chapter 11. It's the third time the legal tactic has failed. J&J now says it will defend its baby powder in court against claims that asbestos contamination caused cancer. The company's also reformulated its baby powder to use cornstarch rather than talc. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker has been speaking now for the past 15 hours straight on the floor of the U.S. Senate. He's criticizing the Trump administration on its actions, including tariffs, rejecting U.S. allies, and on immigration. Booker has been supported by other Democratic senators who joined him in speaking throughout the night. The video sharing app TikTok is full of people sharing personal symptoms they say are connected to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. NPR's Burley McCoy reports on a study that looks at the accuracy of these videos.
A recent study in PLOS ONE had clinical psychologists rate the accuracy of 100 popular ADHD TikTok videos. and they found less than half of the claims made in these videos aligned with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, a tool that mental health experts use to help diagnose and treat their patients. No video got a perfect score, the researcher said, and many lacked nuance. Researchers warn that when people think they have ADHD based on these videos, it could prevent them from getting the help they need, since these symptoms could be rooted in other disorders, such as depression or anxiety. Instead, they suggest people see a therapist if they can, and always check the credentials of the TikTokers who are sharing medical advice. Burleigh McCoy, NPR News.
Chances are lessening rescuers will find survivors from last Friday's massive earthquake in Myanmar and Thailand. More than 2,700 people have been killed in Myanmar. Another 20 died in Thailand. Images from Myanmar's city of Mandalay, near the epicenter, show parts of the city are in ruins. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. It's been a rough few months in the stock market. Both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ Composite just closed out their worst quarter in 3 years.
Investors are bracing for more turbulence as President Trump prepares to unveil the next phase in his trade war, what he's calling Liberation Day. Trump has said he will impose reciprocal tariffs to match the duties other countries place on American goods.
NPR Scott Horsley joins us now. So, Scott, why are investors so concerned about tariffs?
Well, hey, tariffs are taxes. They generally push up prices. They're a potential drag on spending, and they invite retaliation against U.S. exports. On top of that, you've got the unpredictable way the Trump administration has rolled out his tariff agenda, on one day, off the next, back on again. All that just adds the uncertainty and makes it very hard for businesses to plan.
All right, then how does the U.S. stack up against other countries when it comes to trade barriers?
Since the Second World War, the U.S. has generally pushed to lower trade barriers, not raise them. But there have always been a few domestic industries that have enjoyed special protection, and those offer some clues about how Trump's protectionist instincts might play out in other parts of the economy. One of the most protected industries in this country is sugar. The U.S. has high trade barriers against imported sugar. As a result, the price of sugar in this country is usually about twice what it is on the world market. Now, that might not be a big deal if you're just putting a spoonful of sugar in your coffee every morning, but it's a very big deal if you buy sugar by the truckload, like Kirk Vashaw does. He's the CEO of Spangler Candy, which makes Dum Dums, Bit of Honey, and candy canes in Bryan, Ohio. His is one of the last hard candy manufacturers that still operates in this country.
Chicago used to be the candy capital of the United States, and it's not anymore. It's been hollowed out. If you go in the candy aisle and look at the hard candy, you'll see most of it is made outside the United States. It's not the cost of the labor, it's the cost of the sugar.
So lesson one, trade barriers drive up cost, and while that's meant higher profits for U.S. sugar producers, it's been very expensive for all the businesses and consumers who buy sweets. In some cases, it's driven them out of the country.
Trade barriers not only affect the bottom line, but also how businesses operate too, right?
Yeah, and a good example of that is the so-called chicken tax. Back in the 1960s, Germany slapped a tariff on imported chickens from the U.S., so the U.S. retaliated with a tax on imported pickup trucks. And that pickup truck tariff is still in place decades later. And the tariff is 25%, 10 times what the U.S. had been charging on imported cars. That's why you see a lot of imported cars in the U.S., but very few imported pickup trucks. There's a deep protectionist moat around the U.S. pickup market. And chief economist Eugenio Alemán of Raymond James says that's why domestic automakers have put so much of their focus on building pickup trucks and SUVs.
It is more profitable to produce light trucks than to be competitive in sedans. Basically, the U.S. auto manufacturers abandoned any idea of competing in the global economy with small cars.
And so that's a second lesson from these protected industries. Industries that are protected by high trade barriers typically have less incentive to invest and innovate and compete in worldwide markets. And you know, this week, President Trump is widening that moat around pickup trucks to protect domestic autos with a 25% tariff as well.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thanks.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration says it is reviewing about $9 billion in funding for Harvard. It's the latest school to be targeted for what the administration says is a failure to protect students from anti-Semitism. Philosopher Jason Stanley believes investigations like that, with ultimatums tied to federal funding, are a threat to academic freedom. Such a threat that he's leaving Yale University and the United States to teach American studies at the University of Toronto. Jason Stanley is the author of two books on fascism, including his latest, Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. So, Professor, why don't you believe that higher education in general, and Yale in particular, will protect your academic freedom?
Because the federal government, this fascist regime, has figured out a way to target funds to universities. And what we're seeing are democratic institutions across the United States, including universities, capitulate to these demands.
If Yale, Professor, had told you maybe off the record that they were going to try and work behind the scenes maybe to protect academic freedom, but that it would be much more difficult to do without the federal funds, how would you have responded to that?
I would respond by saying that's the wrong tack. You need a very loud defense of democratic institutions. That response would not take seriously the point that this is a war. We cannot fight this unless we recognize that this administration wants to take down the universities because they want to target intellectuals. That's what fascists always do. And so if universities think they can work behind the scenes and make friends, they're simply confused about the nature of the conflict. Yale University, like other leading universities, needs to take the lead, take a leadership role, and collectively work with other universities loudly to protect democracy.
But what war can be won without funding?
You might lose anyway. But you can't win a war unless you recognize it's a war. This way, they're going to pick us off one by one. And history is watching here. Our institutions will be written about. They're being attacked under this entirely fake reason that's furthermore fomenting anti-Semitism in the United States. It's going to create mass popular anger against Jewish people. So if universities want to fight anti-Semitism, they need to stand up and say, no, we are not threats to American Jews. You are threatening American Jews.
So, Professor, I mean, if Ivy League schools with their long established history and powerful, wealthy, connected alumni can't or won't push back, I mean, what hope do other universities have to protect their academic freedoms?
They don't have any hope of protecting their academic freedoms unless Ivy League schools take a loud and proud leadership role and collectively work with other universities using our endowments to protect them. That's our only hope. And again, I mean, what we're seeing is we're seeing students being arrested and sent to brutal Louisiana prisons for co-authoring op-eds in student newspapers. This isn't going to end anytime soon.
Wouldn't it be more helpful in that fight, Professor, for you to stay at Yale to fight that fight as opposed to being in Canada?
I have black Jewish children, and the attacks on DEI are attacks on black people. They're attacking black history. They're targeting black people in positions of power, and they're creating mass popular anger against Jewish people by taking Jewish people, by setting us up and saying, you know, we're the excuse for taking down democracy. And, you know, personally, I'm not going to risk my kids' safety for a political point. And finally, by leaving, I'm making a political point. I'm making the political point that I'm repeating history of Jewish intellectuals leaving a country in the face of a fascist regime.
Now, you've written two books on fascism, seeing that history as a cautionary tale. So how much did that play into your decision to leave?
Well, it played into my decision because my work over the last decade has been calling attention to the rise of fascism in the United States. And you can only write so much. At some point, you have to do something. And this action that I'm doing of uprooting my family, of leaving an institution I love, Yale University, to the University of Toronto, which, let's be clear, is a great university. And I'm also leaving because of Toronto is setting up an institution in the center that will be central in this fight.
And so the political dynamics in Canada, how are they different? Because you, as you are talking, are clearly seeing it as a place where you can maybe work more freely.
That's right. I mean, the university, I have the privilege and good fortune to get a job there, and they have a long-term plan of creating a center that will be a refuge for politicians, journalists, and professors from democratically backsliding or authoritarian countries like the United States or Russia, and to help us. And my job, along with others, will be to work with these people to jointly strategize about how to return our countries to democracy.
The Trump administration's argument, Professor, is that it's fighting back against anti-Semitism on campus. How do you respond to that?
It's setting us up. It's anti-Semitic. What they're doing, $9 billion from Harvard is what they're threatening now. Columbia University, hundreds of millions of dollars so far. They're targeting intellectuals in the name of, supposedly in the name of Jewish people. What's happening is like what Stalin did in the Soviet Union, setting up large groups of people for popular rage. And Jewish people who are complicit or actively participating in this are setting us American Jews up. We've never been at the center of U.S. politics like this, and this is never good for the Jews.
Professor, you got about 30 seconds. There are plenty of other educators around the country that maybe can't leave the country if they wanted to. What's your message to them?
I have the incredible privilege to leave the country under these conditions. And I don't want to moralize or lecture because I am taking advantage of that privilege. But I would say, as we watch this crackdown continue, to speak up loudly when you can and watch out for the conditions that suggest you can't.
Professor Jason Stanley of Yale University, soon to join the University of Toronto, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Yale said last week that, quote, faculty members make decisions about their careers for a variety of reasons, and the university respects all such decisions. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning critic Hilton Alves joins us to discuss his latest exhibition, which challenges the way we see art, identity, and storytelling. He's been a staff writer at The New Yorker for over 30 years, writing theater reviews, essays, and profiles of figures like Toni Morrison, Richard Pryor, and Prince. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Drexel University, whose model of experiential education allows students to choose their own path and explore the world, enabling them to discover their perfect career. More at drexel.edu. From EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Israel says today that Palestinians in yet another area of Gaza need to evacuate. Israel is warning that it is returning to, quote, intense operations across the region as it ramps up its military campaign to pressure Hamas to release hostages. And Israeli police are pursuing a criminal investigation against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's senior advisors. We have new details about all these developments from NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
Could you just start with the latest in Gaza?
Israel's military is ordering more and more Palestinians to evacuate their areas in Gaza. Yesterday, it was the south of Gaza. Today, it's northern Gaza, where militants launched a rocket toward Israel. All of this is part of a military campaign that has been steadily building in recent weeks. Israeli airstrikes have killed Hamas leaders and hundreds of women and children. And troops have also killed a group of Palestinian medics and emergency responders. The United Nations said it found their bodies. Israel says they thought their ambulances were suspicious vehicles. And beyond Gaza, Israel's military campaign has also expanded to Lebanon. An airstrike today killed a Hezbollah militant. And Israeli troops are also extending farther into Syria. So you see Israel projecting a more aggressive posture in the region.
What's behind Israel's strategy?
When it comes to Gaza, Israel says this is all part of a pressure campaign on Hamas to get Hamas to agree to release more Israeli hostages who were taken in the October 7th attack in 2023. Israel submitted a new ceasefire proposal over the weekend. An Israeli official not authorized to give details publicly has told NPR that Israel is demanding that Hamas release 11 hostages, including an American-Israeli dual national. So that's about half of the living hostages in Gaza. And then Israel is proposing a 40-day ceasefire and talks toward ending the war. We have not heard a response yet from Hamas. But part of the pressure campaign on Hamas to accept these terms is a complete Israeli siege on Gaza. Israel's blocking medical supplies and food. The World Food Program says it has run out of flour in Gaza, and so bakeries are shutting down across Gaza.
Meanwhile, Israel's prime minister has been questioned by police. Tell us about that.
Two of Benjamin Netanyahu's spokespeople were arrested yesterday, and Netanyahu himself gave testimony to police. The allegations are that his advisors were secretly getting paid by Qatar to improve the country's image and interests. Now, this has stirred a lot of controversy in Israel. Netanyahu is accused of pushing a policy allowing Qatar to fund Hamas for years. Netanyahu calls this a political witch hunt, but really, Michelle, it's a critical moment for the war in Gaza. The man at the center is embattled at home.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
The wildfires that swept through Los Angeles in January wiped out historical landmarks. NPR's Chloe Veltman visited two landmarks here, one that was destroyed and another that was in danger, to see how they are working to preserve the past.
Zane Grey was a huge household name in the 1920s and 30s. He used the income from his wildly popular novels set on the American frontier to purchase a Mediterranean revival-style estate in the Altadena neighborhood of Los Angeles.
He loved the American West. There was a lot of the American West in this house.
Nathaniel Grewe loved that house. He purchased it with his wife in 2020. It had high wood-beamed ceilings and airy balconies. Light streamed through its many big windows.
Almost like a cathedral vibe when you walked in.
The shattered glass from those windows is now underfoot, along with blackened wood, twisted gutters, and broken pieces of ceramic. All that's left standing are the sturdy concrete walls. They still bear faint traces of the home's grand Western spirit. Grewe's wife, Alice Carr, points to a wall painted with Hopi spiritual figures.
You can see the white stencils made it through the fire, even though the paint itself is gone.
The big question now is, what's next? Carr says it's impossible to return the property to what it was in Zane Grey's day.
This structure was incredibly unique, using really high-quality old-growth wood and products that just don't exist today.
Grewe adds they have no interest in using modern materials to build a Zane Grey estate look-alike.
Sort of Las Vegas version of a historic house.
The couple says they'd rather reframe the author's legacy in a way that makes sense for an era where human-caused climate change creates increasing threats.
We live in an area prone for wildfires where water is scarce. How do you create something that
has a nod to Zane Grey, but also creates these houses with this architectural sustainability in mind?
That can be sometimes a delicate balance.
Sari Warden is with the National Trust for Historic Preservation. She says adding a metal roof or removing flammable plants may increase a historic landmark's chances of surviving a wildfire. But these interventions, if not done carefully, can wreck what makes these places special.
How we can ensure that we can adapt the historic materials without losing the power these places have.
This is a question Cheryl Scott takes to heart. She's the director of communications and operations at the Gamble House, owned by the city of Pasadena. The 1908 property is a crowning example of American arts and crafts design, a sprawl of redwood shingles and copper pipes.
We are an enormous wood structure. So fire makes all of us very nervous.
Scott says her team has been making complex decisions. Should they remove the beautiful creeping figs clinging to the facade? They decided no, it would be just as effective to keep those nearby trees and shrubs trimmed. And how best to protect the historic but extremely flammable shingles, also known as shakes? That's a topic of ongoing investigation.
We can't replace our shakes with, you know, fakes. The integrity of the structure, the historic content, is important to us.
Whatever they do will cost money. Scott says it's a hard time for California landmarks to get grants for protecting or rehabilitating historic sites against disasters. The state's Office of Historic Preservation doesn't offer them. Federal funding sources like the National Park Service are also facing cuts under the Trump administration.
Everyone's nervous about the amount of money that's available.
With limited resources, Scott says her team is figuring out what to prioritize in order to keep the Gamble House standing for future generations. Chloe Veltman, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Summer vacations are right around the corner, and if you're thinking of visiting Paris and the Louvre, here's one thing you should know.
Never go to the Louvre on an empty stomach or with a full bladder.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A new book walks you through the best way to navigate the world's largest museum. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly.
Bodies continue to be found in Myanmar amid the destruction caused by Friday's powerful earthquake. The death toll now tops 2,700. At least 20 people were killed by the quake in neighboring Thailand. The State Department says it's sending some aid officials to Myanmar to help identify needs. Critics say the U.S. response has been slow because the Trump administration has dismantled the lead aid agency, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Normally, the U.S. Agency for International Development is on the scene early in disasters, with rescue teams helping in the search for survivors. But on the same day as this earthquake, the Trump administration sent out notices to remaining USAID employees, cutting their jobs. An Obama-era aid official, Jeremy Kanondike, puts it this way.
They have broken the U.S.'s ability to respond to international disasters. Will they now restore it? They should. I'm not seeing any indication that they will.
State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce rejects that. She says things might not look the same, but the U.S. is helping with up to $2 million in aid to relief groups in Myanmar. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Department of Health and Human Services has begun laying off thousands of employees. This is NPR News from Washington. A federal bankruptcy judge in Texas is rejecting Johnson & Johnson's latest plan to settle billions of dollars worth of claims related to the company's baby powder containing talc and cancer litigation. Health officials in Rhode Island say the Trump administration's decision to revoke billions of dollars in COVID-era grants from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will have a major impact on the state. Lynn Arditti with the Publix Radio says the cuts will mean fewer federal dollars for programs such as childhood vaccinations.
Rhode Island Health Director Jerome Larkin says CDC grants helped pay for things like tracking foodborne illness and vaccination outreach. He says the state's high vaccination rates are why Rhode Island escaped a measles outbreak in January when an unvaccinated child became infected.
I can assure you that if we had had lower vaccination rates, that we would have a measles pandemic or epidemic right now, similar to the one that's in Texas and New Mexico.
But Dr. Larkin says Rhode Island's vaccination program could be crippled by the loss of $31 million in CDC grants. The grants made up nearly 11% of the state health department's budget. For NPR News, I'm Lynn Arditti in Providence.
Stocks on Wall Street are lower this morning. The Dow is down 374 points. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. There are two special elections in Florida today that have attracted national attention and millions in campaign spending. The races are for two seats in Congress in districts that are heavily Republican, but as NPR's Greg Allen reports, Democrats think they have a chance to flip them.
The central issue in the Florida races is President Trump. He leaned heavily on Florida to staff his administration. The seat in Florida's first congressional district on the panhandle was left vacant when Republican Matt Gaetz was nominated to be his attorney general. Gaetz later withdrew and left Congress, leaving his seat open. Florida's chief financial officer, Republican Jimmy Patronis, is running for the seat with Trump's endorsement. His opponent is Democrat Gay Valamont, who's raised more than $6 million, several times that of her opponent. In the other race in Florida's 6th congressional district on the East Coast, candidates are looking to fill a seat left vacant when Republican Mike Waltz was named Trump's national security advisor. The Republican in that race, Randy Fine, has also been endorsed by Trump, who did a campaign call for him last week.
Randy will always have a very open door to the Oval Office. He will be there whenever I need him.
Fine's Democratic opponent, Josh Wheel, has raised some $10 million, 10 times that of his opponent. Two recent polls show that race within the margin of error, a dramatic turnaround from November when the incumbent Republican won by more than 30 points. Democratic Party Chairman Ken Martin was in Florida campaigning for Wheel over the weekend.
And I'll tell you, the response of it has been overwhelming for Josh Wheel. We have a real shot to win this on Tuesday.
Democrats think these races give them a chance to whittle down the narrow majority Republicans currently have in Congress. President Trump indicated he was concerned about that possibility when he announced last week that New York Republican Representative Elise Stefanik was withdrawing as his nominee to be UN ambassador. Instead, she'll remain in Congress. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
When the Trump administration suspended migrants' ability to claim asylum in the U.S., it left those already in the country awaiting court hearings in limbo. Dozens of houses of worship in Southern California are sheltering asylum seekers in that situation. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose spent time with some of those congregations.
The education building is quiet but full at Grace Lutheran Church in the city of Bell. Pastor Maria Elena Cruz de Montalvo gives a tour of former Sunday school classrooms. She's pointing to ones where her church is sheltering migrants from Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador, and elsewhere in Latin America.
And this room is the father and one son.
So all told, how many do you have living here?
45.
Including a group of 20 Muslims from North Africa.
Los Mauritanos, dile que vinieron huyendo de la esclavitud de su país.
Mauritanians, according to Montalvo, who say they fled slavery in their home country. They made their way to the southern U.S. border more than a year ago and claimed asylum. NPR agreed to use only the first name of one of them, Baba, because he fears speaking publicly could bring the ire of immigration officials.
Mauritania is not good because he have more racism, they live and everything, no good under Mauritania.
No life in his home country, Baba says, because of racism in the form of enslavement of black Mauritanians by Arab Berbers. Here at Grace Lutheran, Baba sleeps on a cushion in one of the larger classrooms, all his life held in plastic bags. While Baba's asylum status is unclear, his court hearing is more than a year away, Pastor Montalvo wants him to be certain of God's love.
Enseñando. Amándolos y caminando con ellos, como Jesús hizo, caminar con uno.
She says the church teaches her to love and walk with those in need, regardless of their religion, as Jesus did, so that no one walks alone. Montalvo immigrated to the U.S. from Mexico decades ago and knows how hard this journey is. She takes both her solace and her direction from a passage in the Gospel of John.
Dios amó tanto al mundo que dio a su hijo para morir por nosotros. Y ahí nos muestra la misericordia que él tuvo con nosotros.
God so loved the world, Montalvo recites, that he gave his only son. She wants her church to embody a mercy similar to God's, because these migrants have no other place to go.
After the election, the landscape has changed for us.
Guillermo Torres oversees immigration programs for the group CLUE, Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice. CLUE, along with the ACLU and other groups, helped negotiate the release of the Mauritanians from a government detention center and asked Grace Lutheran to take them in.
So there's a lot of discernment how us as faith communities are going to be in solidarity with a very vulnerable community at this moment.
CLUE has more than 30 congregations in Southern California currently housing migrants with varying levels of legal status.
the greatest commandment after loving God with all your heart, soul, and mind is to love your neighbor as yourself. Our immigration work, it's like, I'm not going to betray God, and I'm not going to betray that commandment. And I'm not going to turn my back on God, and I'm not going to turn my back on an immigrant.
In South Los Angeles at Heritage United Methodist Church, Reverend Ivan Seviano is showing off the progress volunteer construction workers and plumbers are making in the basement.
And they're working with these restrooms. They're trying to fix it and have a shower, put a shower.
The goal is a more hospitable refuge.
Hello, soy el pastor.
In a former meeting room, Seviano introduces me to Geraldine. She and her two young children sleep on cots hidden behind office cubicle dividers. The family arrived here from Venezuela 3 months ago. NPR agreed to use just her first name because she fears what the Venezuelan government might do to family members still there.
Ay, para mí es muy importante. Estoy, como se dice, sola acá con mis hijos en su totalidad y aquí me siento refugiada.
Geraldine says what this church offers her is very important because she and her kids are in this country alone with no place to call home. They'd been living on the streets of L.A. before Heritage Methodist took them in.
In a biblical way, it's a demand that is presented on the Old Testament to welcome the strangers.
Pastor Seviano says this is a lesson he learned growing up in Peru and coming to the U.S. years ago. He has a work visa, but he's not a citizen, so he knows this work is risky. But it's a risk he's willing to take because it's a risk that God takes.
God is here with people, walk with people. God is a God that suffers with them. It's a God that is in solidarity with them.
Because of God's solidarity with migrants, he says, God's church must be in solidarity with migrants as well. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
An Alpine town in France continues to investigate a cluster of ALS cases, 16 deaths in all. Why the culprit could be a mushroom, next time, Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. A city can try to slow down speeding cars with traffic lights, stop signs, speed bumps, or what Montgomery Township in Pennsylvania did by painting yellow lane dividers all squiggly like a snake, which in theory means cars need to slow down as they weave back and forth. It's called a chicane. Drivers have called it an eyesore. Weird, awkward, ridiculous, and one person even says that everyone is just driving right down the middle of it. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. There are more billionaires than ever. That's the takeaway from Forbes' annual list of the world's wealthiest people. The latest version is out this morning and includes a record 3,028 billionaires. Elon Musk at the top, President Donald Trump, and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick are also in there as well, as are celebrities such as Jerry Seinfeld, Bruce Springsteen, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Here to discuss is Forbes senior editor Chase Peterson-Withorn. So, Chase, the boss is a new addition. 100 people, though, have dropped off the list. Any particular themes to this year's list?
So, you know, you sort of hit it there. It's a crazy record year for billionaires. This is the first year we found more than 3,000 of them around the world. They're richer than ever, up $2 trillion just from a year ago. And it's a great time to be a billionaire. That's for sure.
If you're a billionaire, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe not. Maybe it's terrible to have all that money. Now, how do you figure out that these are actually the richest people in the world? Is it about what tangible assets they have or what things may be valued at?
Yeah. So, you know, we dig very deep. Upwards of 100 reporters around the world put together this list. And, you know, we're going through everything from shares in publicly traded companies, trying to value private companies, looking at, you know, cash and investments and how billionaires might be, you know, spending their money. And then everything from art and yachts and car collections and dinosaur bone collections and all kinds of crazy stuff billionaires own. So it's sort of what the total value of all of their assets are, minus any debt that they have. You know, so some of them might have $1 billion in the bank. Other ones might not have $1 billion in cash, but they may have a company that, you know, they could sell for a lot of money if they wanted to.
Do billionaires just say, hey, this is what I got, Chase. Let me show you all my records.
Some of them do.
Some of them do. Oh, my God. Well,
yes, okay. They do. And they're very interesting conversations. But, you know, a lot of them don't. And so, yeah, we have to dig deep looking through, you know, government registries, but also legal filings and offshore registries and leaks and interviewing billionaires and their handlers and their competitors and all of that to try to sort of follow the money and uncover, you know, try to find answers to questions that a lot of billionaires maybe would rather we don't ask.
So for someone like, say, Russian President Vladimir Putin, I mean, how do you figure out how much he's worth? I mean, I guess a lot, but I can't say I know for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we're in the same boat. So, you know, Putin is not on the list. He very well may deserve to be on the list. And, you know, it's sort of one of those great white whales of we would love to put an exact number on Putin. We're always calling sources, always, you know, trying to figure out how to figure it out. But it's one of those things that it seems pretty much nobody knows the answer to, you know, maybe not even Putin himself. But if anybody out there has any thoughts on Putin, we'd love to hear it.
Maybe President Putin will give you a call somehow.
Yeah, maybe.
Let you know exactly what he has. Now, wondering, you know, with this list, it's a fascination for a lot of people. They want to see where people rank. Do you think the perception of billionaires has changed in the public's mind over the years?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I've been doing this for a little over a decade now, and you can see how it shifts. I mean, we had the Occupy Wall Street movement. You know, now we have sort of a billionaire president bringing a lot of billionaires into his government. And so you can see a lot of pushback and backlash against that. But it also depends on what side of the coin you're sort of looking at. You know, I mean, a lot of billionaires don't have great reputations these days. But on the other hand, they're more powerful than ever.
What side of the coin? I hear what you're doing there, Chase. Chase Peterson-Withorn is senior editor of Forbes magazine. Chase, thanks.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
The worst quarter in 3 years.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab knows that investors want control of their financial future. That's why when it comes to wealth management, Schwab is dedicated to giving investors more choices. More at schwab.com. And by Amazon Business, committed to business buying solutions to empower leaders to streamline and focus on growth. Learn more about smart business buying at amazonbusiness.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. The first quarter of 2025 is over. It was the worst quarter for U.S. stocks since the pandemic year of 2022. The Dow is down 2% so far this year. The S&P 500 is down almost 5% for the year. And Goldman Sachs analysts predict it'll fall another 5% the next quarter. I do not need to tell you by now that a lot of this comes down to tariffs, and the White House is expected to announce a whole boatload more of them tomorrow. As per usual, it's not clear what we will get exactly, but the White House is reportedly considering 20% across the board tariffs. For more on this, we've got David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist at JP Morgan Funds. Good morning.
Good morning.
So as we mentioned, you know, markets are quite down this quarter as a whole. Can you walk us through the specific concerns about tariffs that have people actually valuing the future performance of companies lower?
Well, I think we should start with the fact that, of course, stocks were very high going into this year. There was a lot of excitement about AI and also excitement about the prospect of deregulation, which might make companies more profitable. But I think the president's agenda, as he's rolled it out, and particularly on tariffs, has scared people. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty. But also we know that historically tariffs tend to slow economic growth and raise inflation. And neither of those things are good for corporate profits. And I think that is one of the reasons why we did have a significant drop in the stock market in the first quarter.
The president, the Treasury Secretary, the Commerce Secretary, they have all either said explicitly or implied that, yeah, okay, maybe we'll go through some economic pain, but on the other side of it, we're going to get this resurgence of U.S. industry, U.S. manufacturing. That doesn't appear to be showing up in the calculations of analysts. Why not?
Because if you're in the serious business of making money in financial markets, you can, you know, listen to political rhetoric, or you can listen to the advice of economists and economic historians for over a century who will tell you that tariffs generally end up hurting both sides, both yourself and your trading partners. They tend to slow economic growth, raise prices, slow productivity, hurt profits. They increase inequality. It's a most unfair tax. And they increase global tensions. I mean, apart from that, they're fine. But generally speaking, economists, the people who study this as their life's work, tell you that tariffs do not help economies grow.
David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist at JP Morgan Funds. Thank you so much.
Anytime.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is down 120 points. That's 0.3%. The S&P 500 is pretty much flat. The NASDAQ is up 0.2%. And the yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.164%. Hooters has filed for bankruptcy protection. The restaurant chain has faced a parade of problems, including lawsuits over its hiring practices. Also, $376 million in debt. Debt is actually something a lot of restaurants are struggling with right now. Some took on debt to survive the pandemic when they had to close their doors. Others have had debt from even before that. And 5+ years later, the cost of these loans is still weighing on them, especially small restaurants. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has more.
When the pandemic hit, Michael Shemtove owned 10 restaurants in Charleston and Nashville. He ended up closing a bunch of them, but not before taking out federal economic injury disaster loans to try to keep them open.
I have $4,000 to $5,000 a month of payments that I make on loans that we took out during COVID to save restaurants that couldn't be saved.
Pandemic loans are coming due for lots of restaurant owners at a time when business is slowing. Trevor Boomstra at Alex Partners says 2021 and 22 were great years for restaurants.
People were all wanting to go out to restaurants to reconnect with their friends, spend money.
But these days, he says people are going out less and costs are up for almost everything. Kurt Huffman owns the restaurant group Chef's Table in Portland, Oregon. And he says some businesses are also still waiting on money the federal government owes them for keeping staff employed during lockdown.
It's just a huge amount of money. So I think that there's kind of a financial tail.
In the last year, he's heard from a number of restaurant owners saying they want out.
It's just been too hard. We kind of dragged ourselves through the pandemic and we've kind of survived. But I think the question a lot of people are asking themselves is survival good enough?
And he says the answer now for many is no, it's not. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Layoffs have begun this morning at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration. This is according to Reuters. Some employees found out only when they got to work and their badges didn't work. The White House has a goal of cutting 10,000 jobs, the Department of Health and Human Services.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Affinity, provider of the CRM for the private capital relationship economy. Affinity knows who has the best relationship with the right startup. Affinity knows. Learn more at affinity.co/marketplace. And by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at viking.com.
President Trump has signed an executive order aimed at curbing ticket scalping for live events. Trump made the announcement in the Oval Office yesterday with Kid Rock looking over his shoulder. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
The executive order pretty much tells federal officials to enforce existing laws on ticket scalping, instructing Attorney General Pam Bondi and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to ensure ticket resellers are in compliance with the IRS. Scalpers are supposed to report ticket sale proceeds over $600 a year. The executive order also tells Bondi and Bessent to prevent anti-competitive conduct. The White House says scalpers use bots to scoop up face value tickets and resell them at an enormous markup. Last year, the Biden administration sued Ticketmaster and its parent company, Live Nation, accusing them of running an illegal monopoly. Live Nation issued a statement yesterday. It thanked President Trump for taking on the bots. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.